think he's got the same problem.
Okay, you good to go? Ready?
Yes, so we need this. All right, fascinating.
Welcome to the first episode of Unapologetic. Today we're joined by Pastor Mundhir Ishaq, who is from Bethlehem. He recently gave a speech on Christmas Day about the unfolding crisis in Gaza. And since then, he's gained a lot of prominence. Mundhir, it's going to be a long conversation. We're going to be here for a long time. We're going to speak about you, your life experiences, growing up as a Palestinian Christian. And then obviously, we're going to speak about the unfolding crisis in Gaza. First up, you were born in Bethlehem, the same town that Jesus was born in. How has that fact impacted your reality and life?
To be honest, when people ask me this question, many times they assume that my answer will focus on Bethlehem being the birthplace of Jesus and how special it is to live just a few meters from the famous Shepherd's Field in Beit Sahur, or to be around the Church of Nativity. But to me, growing up, what I remember the most is the First Intifada, the struggles to live, the demonstrations in front of our house, in the neighborhood, the excitement of children playing football and then running away from Israeli soldiers, or the excitement of breaking the Israeli curfew to go to friends or to buy food to our family as a child who could maneuver between neighborhoods and get by things quickly. This is what I remember growing up. And the idea that Bethlehem is the birthplace of Jesus, at the time at least, as a child, wasn't a defining thing in my growing up. But the defining things, as I said, were what happened on a daily basis during the First Intifada. The First Intifada broke when I was, what, 9?
Yep.
So this is what I remember growing up, the school, the strikes, and
so on. You mentioned the First Intifada. Do you have any vivid memories of confrontations that you may have had with security forces or anything in particular? At that particular point in your life?
Of course, we all have these memories. And the things that stay with me, things like shooting outside of the house and the fear, you know, lying down on the floor, fearing that bullets will enter the house. I remember a moment when we were demonstrating, and at the time, it was not even allowed to carry a Palestinian flag. So we had to knit them in the houses. And then it was like a peak in the demonstration when someone brings a Palestinian flag, and I brought one, and they carried me on the one someone's shoulder.
This was 1987, right?
88, 89.
87, 89, okay.
Another incident that I remember also too well is we were playing football in the neighborhood, and then the soldiers came. And back then, demonstrations, when young people demonstrated, they would block the roads with stones so that Israeli cars cannot drive easily between roads and get to them. So every now and then, Israeli soldiers would come and pick up young people and ask them to clean the roads. So they came
clean
to us.
In what way? Like just move the rocks away?
Move the rocks away, okay. Yes. Sometimes wash the slogans that young people wrote on the walls. And I was young back then, and I couldn't carry the stones, so my friends, the bigger ones, would clean the roads, and I was watching them. I don't know what made me laugh, but I looked at them and smiled or laughed, and the soldier came to me and said, "Is this funny?" I said no, and then he slapped me in the face. I'll never forget that.
And this was about when you were like 9 or 10 years old?
9 or 10, yes. So these are the kind of many memories that many of us have growing up, especially in the First Intifada.
When you were 9 or 10 year old and the Intifada was happening, I mean, obviously when you look back at it now, you can understand what the Intifada meant or what it means to you. But as a 9 or 10 year old, what was it in your mind? Was it just, this is life, this is chaos? How did it actually play out, and how did you process it as a child growing up?
Yes, you don't process it. You don't have an in-depth analysis. What I remember also is the sense of unity and pride we had, and that we were united as a people. It was clear that it was a David versus Goliath moment, in the sense that we had nothing but our resilience and our unity as people against a well-equipped military.
Was there a sense that even as a child that you are more or less, it's not just that you are much, you are a David Goliath scenario, but you are where you have a much more superior opposition against you. But did you get a sense as a child even that as Palestinians you are more or less almost alone? That obviously you have, I think there's was always been a vast, you know, societal enthusiasm and support for the cause, but do you feel that even as a young person for the Palestinian cause, do you feel that, you know, you were isolated and you felt alone even then?
At the time, I think our strength was our unity. And it wasn't until later that I began to see how the world thinks of us Palestinians, and that I began understanding that many Christians in the West actually don't see us and see only one side of the equation. But when you live it in the inside, and you have to remember this is way before the social media or even normal TV coverage, and it felt that we have one another to support. One of the things I remember, I wasn't in the event, but I remember how everybody talked about it, was the visit of Desmond Tutu to Palestine, particularly to Beit Sahur, to Bethlehem.
Do you remember what year this war more or less was in?
Late 80s.
Okay.
Right after he won the Nobel Prize. And he came, he even joked about apartheid back then, remember. And it was a big, big moment. This was also when Beit Sahur, I can't remember if the visit was after or before, my hometown Beit Sahur did the civil disobedience against Israel, and we stopped paying taxes to the Israeli occupation. Talking about the slogan, no taxation without representation. As occupied people, why should we pay taxes to our occupiers? And Beit Sahur was besieged, there was curfew, and Israeli forces would raid one house after the other and estimate, you owe us this amount of money for taxes, we're going to confiscate this much from you. And
how would they confiscate it? Through your bank directly or just take goods
from
your home?
No, they would take goods. They would bring a truck.
Oh, wow.
Take the furniture. In our case, they took the car.
And it was just random. It was just random calculations.
Yeah, one house after the other. Many, many people lost their businesses.
And this was still during the Intifada?
Is all during the first Intifada,
okay.
Yes. And as I said, it's our sense of unity that brought us together. And when I say sense of unity, I also think of homeschooling. Schools were closed during the first Intifada, so in neighborhoods we would arrange ourselves and go on with our classes. And people volunteered to teach. Homes were open for us to come and do classes in homes because Israel closed the schools. So when I say a sense of community and unity, this is what I remember most about those days.
I want to start moving to what was the start of what's called the peace process in 1992. But before that, you mentioned Desmond Tutu came to Palestine. I'm sure that was, and then, I mean, shortly after that, just South Africa did start becoming free. And obviously there's always been parallels between the struggle of the Palestinians and the struggles of South Africans for freedom. Around Oslo, and obviously in the back of the Cold War ending, the Berlin Wall coming down, South Africa becoming free, was there hope? And what was it like then probably like a 10-year-old or 11-year-old when Oslo was coming around, or even older? What was it like then? Was there a sense of hope, and did you feel that freedom was almost around the corner?
It was more than hope, it was euphoria. We celebrated. We thought that it's over. We truly felt that peace is coming. And it was a sense of, there was a feeling of pride, national identity. Among the vivid pictures we remember is when the last Israeli troops left Bethlehem, and Palestinians in Bethlehem said goodbye to them with flowers. And we felt this is a new era, and that finally our struggle is coming to an end. And it kept building because, you know, the first time we saw Palestinian security forces, that felt so liberating that...
You have your own forces now.
Exactly. I remember Yasser Arafat's first visit to Bethlehem, how much everyone was excited about it. And it felt like a gradual moments of celebrations. And that it's as I said, gradual freedom is coming. Now that I look back at it, I don't think of, you know, we didn't think much of the idea that Israel was building more settlements back then. I think we were as if blinded with what was happening, as if it's too real.
When
to
you
be
say
true.
You mean you as a child, or you mean the entire community, the most
no,
of the
I
society?
No, I mean the Palestinian society.
Yep.
We were too busy building our own
life,
infrastructure, our own future, our future state, while Israel was making sure this never happens by building these settlements. And what I can say with confidence is that for many of us, there was a very honest desire to live in peace. These days were described as, you know, sometimes we joke call them the golden days, because there were so many initiatives to bring Palestinians and Israelis together. The so-called peace industry bloomed in those days.
What kind of initiatives? Can you give me an example?
I'll give you an example from my own life. I sang in a choir. There was an Israeli choir. We did tours together.
And this was in
this was between Oslo and the Second Intifada.
Okay, but just physically, where were you touring? Were you touring in Israel itself?
We went to Germany.
Oh,
we went to Germany, and we also sang in Jerusalem.
And this was a mixed, like...
A Palestinian choir and an Israeli choir together. There were school exchanges, so students from Palestinian schools would visit students from Israeli schools and vice versa, I think. So the idea was that
and
there was this
clarify,
desire.
Just to clarify, were these between Christian Palestinian schools all across?
Everybody. Because as I said, there was good intentions. We truly believed that we can live in peace with our Israeli neighbors.
When did it start becoming clear to the society, or did it even become clear? Was it like, when did you start realizing that maybe Oslo is going to drag on, that the settlements are continuing, that this is not going to end?
I think the defining moments were the election of the Likud government in Israel in the mid-90s, because that clearly indicated that things are not moving in the right direction. And with the failure of Camp David, that was very disappointing. We felt that a breakthrough could happen. And then we were all shocked by the Second Intifada. And I think it's really important to stop at what happened in the Second Intifada, because all these years of, as I said, the peace industry resulted in a very violent period, because we never addressed the core of the issue, the imbalance of powers, the status quo of occupier versus occupied. And this is why many of us are grown very critical of these peace initiatives, normalization, if you wish, normalizing the relationship between Palestinians and Israelis before the occupation ends. Because if you don't address the imbalance in power, and if you don't address the embedded superiority attitudes you can't go anywhere.
Just moving away, I mean, trying to come back to your journey now as a teenager, almost coming into adolescence, at which point did faith start influencing your narrative as a person? Or did you start seeing the struggle from a faith perspective?
For me personally, from a very, very early stage. I am one of those church people who went to church from a very early
stage. Was this a family thing or just personally you?
Siblings thing, okay. Yes. And I was very active in my church even when I was a child. I wouldn't miss a meeting. And I took Sunday school seriously. And among the struggles I can still think of right now, that when you look back, you realize how much these questions shaped the way you think. Questions related to, for example, you know, you read the Bible, especially the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, the first part of our Bible, which focuses on Israel, and you immediately confuse the modern state of Israel with the Israelites of the Bible. And then the Philistines in the Bible with the modern Palestinian people. And this is where the confusion happens, because in the Bible, there are good guys and bad guys. The Israelites are the good guys. So how do you reconcile that with the reality? Yes, it was a struggle, to be honest. Even the story of David and Goliath that I mentioned was a struggle. How do you... Because it's the other way around, if you wish. I also remember struggling with the idea of violence and nonviolence, even at a very early stage.
Which way did you struggle with it?
So is throwing rocks at Israeli soldiers allowed in Christianity? I mean, this was a very simple question I've asked myself as an 11 or 12 years old kid. Yeah.
In fact, I mean, I think you mention here, you say in your book, which you wrote, you had questions about our role in this conflict. Can we take part in demonstrations against the occupation? Is it okay to throw rocks at the Israeli soldiers? Does that fall under nonviolence? And then you said you had a friend who went to an evangelical church, and he used to take part in demonstrations. He used to tell me that he would throw the rock with one hand and pray with the other. It would not harm the soldier. You were confused.
Yes, and I think the confusing part was that many of us wanted to take part in these demonstrations and wanted to be involved, but we lacked the terminology, the guidance of our churches to do so. Churches in Palestine, for several reasons, adopted a mentality of don't get into politics. And it's always has been the case that the Palestinian Christians who were involved in the movement for liberation did so from a political stance. Many times they would be more or less secular Palestinian Christians.
Was the church's position a position of sort of self-preservation, or was it theological? Where did that come from?
I think it's the idea that we better avoid politics, because we don't want to get ourselves into trouble.
Okay, self-preservation.
And even the clergy who were involved did so on a personal capacity. There wasn't, as you wish, like what we have today in Palestine, a strong theological movement of activists, of documents, of a line of thinking in which we are very engaged from a faith standpoint, not just from our national identity. So the confusion growing up came from that idea, because, and I think I wrote about it also in my book, in our churches they used to tell us the true Jerusalem is in heaven.
Yep.
And the person who would say this actually was a very strong patriotic Palestinian, but somehow we were taught to create a line of division between our Palestinian identity and our Christian faith, something that right now many of us have not just We're not doing this. Actually, we're bringing the two together, talking not just about Palestinian theology, but linking our experience as Palestinian Christians with the life of Jesus as someone who've lived under occupation, under empire as well. So we're coming to terms now with a very strong articulation of our identity as Palestinian Christians and linking it to the experience of Jesus himself.
Let's talk a bit about Palestinian Christians. How many Palestinian Christians are there? Where are you dispersed? Are there many in the diaspora? Are there many in Israel itself? There are very few Christians still left in Gaza, which is potentially the Christian community there could be impacted for a very long time. Let our audience know and me know just where are Christian Palestinians, where do they live, and what's their situation?
Yeah, I think there are many misconceptions when it comes to Palestinian Christians, and let me address them before talking about who we are. The first is that, we exist. And it's only natural that we exist. This is where Christianity started. We've always been in the land. Palestine is our homeland. There's always been a strong Palestinian Christian presence in the land. There were times when we were a majority. And I think the second misconception is that we are a tiny minority caught in the middle, caught in between, as if. And I think it's important to dismantle this line of thinking from two angles. First of all, we're not a tiny minority because you can't think of only the Palestinian Christians who live in the West Bank. Like all Palestinians, we have been fragmented. I think it's a policy of the occupation. And like all Palestinians, the majority of us live in the diaspora. Exile. And our exile began first during the British, the Ottoman Empire. Then the British mandate affected our numbers in a great way. The Nakba, the ongoing Israeli occupation, all of these factors led to a massive immigration of Palestinian Christians. But it's not just immigration, because in many cases
It's forced displacement.
And I'll give you an example that many people don't think of. Many Palestinian Christians left Palestine, especially Bethlehem, during the last days of the Ottoman Empire, because these were very difficult days. And when they left, and then England, the British mandate came, they were not allowed to return. Same with when Israel occupied the land. We always think of the refugees. But let's remember that a good number of Palestinians were already outside the land for several reasons, and they were not allowed to return. So this is what we mean by the forced displacement. So there are many Palestinian Christians in the world. Some recent estimation, I think, spoke about 500,000 Palestinian Christian. Some say more. But within the historic Palestine, right now, I think the number is close to 170 or 180,000. Close to 130,000 live in what is now the state of Israel. They are Palestinian in their nationality and identity, but second-class citizens. And close to 45,000 live in the occupied territories, including East Jerusalem and Gaza. And the number in Gaza is around 900 to 1,000 Palestinian Christians. That number declined close from, 3,000 17 years ago to 1,000 now as a result of the very strong siege and restrictions. So whenever someone had the chance to leave Gaza, they would leave and not come back.
So when did you start seeing faith as something you wanted to do with your life and use that sort of to propel you forward? I understand that when you were growing up, you wanted to be an engineer. Not growing up, but when you were done with school. How far did you get with engineering, and what made you pivot into becoming a theologian?
So I have a degree in civil engineering. I studied at Birzeit University, and this was during the Second Intifada. So another shaping period in my life, a very difficult period when our lives were in danger literally every day, especially going to university and crossing checkpoints. And I knew I wanted to do something to my people. And as a devout Christian who constantly prayed for Palestine, for peace, for justice, I felt led to become a theologian. And it's one of those things that you can't explain.
Do you think if the Second Intifada didn't occur, you'd still become a theologian? Or is it very much the raw confrontation with Israeli power that made you say, I want to do this?
A leading factor in why I studied theology was seeing suffering, seeing injustice, and wanting to do something about it. And I would think long on checkpoints. How can we endure this? How do people endure this? It's so unfair. We would sit in the sun for and wait for 3 hours sometimes on checkpoints. And it was during those periods that I said, I know I have to do something. And as I said, how did I make the connection with I want to help my people with, I want to study theology, is something that I can't explain other than to say God led me into it.
You mentioned checkpoints. As you were growing up, did they get progressively worse? I mean, was it, when's your first experience where you know you're stuck now in the checkpoints for 3-4 hours? Has this always been the case, or has it gotten progressively worse? And just walk us through that.
No, checkpoints were not always. I mean, I remember as a child driving from Bethlehem to Jerusalem with my parents.
And that would take you 20 minutes?
20 minutes.
Yep.
Borders were open. Everything was open.
And this is even before Oslo. This is
yeah. No, yeah. It was after Oslo that we began seeing the checkpoints. And the separation between the two peoples became very clear.
And was it 20 minutes to 4 hours, just like overnight, or was there progressive?
So when we say 4 hours, sometimes it's what we call in Palestine a flying checkpoint, an unpredictable checkpoint where Israeli cars stop in the middle of the road and they began searching every car. Or delays on major checkpoints sometimes could take to these long hours. And sometimes checkpoints, you know, you cannot cross. So the checkpoint between Bethlehem and Jerusalem was, when it began, cars parking on the next of the road and not allowing people to pass, then a small tower and fences, and now it's a big crossing area.
So it starts off as police checks.
Yeah, and now it grew into this long. And the major checkpoint separating Bethlehem to Jerusalem, very few people are permitted to cross. You need a permit from the military to cross from Bethlehem to Jerusalem. It's always shocking to visitors, pilgrims, tourists who've come to Bethlehem to realize that the majority of Bethlehemites have never seen Jerusalem. Just think of that. And we can see Jerusalem from our windows.
Which you can't visit.
But we can't visit. Very few people are allowed to visit. Those who have... who are in, you know, work, have go to cheap labor in Jerusalem, those in the medical sector, and if Israel is, decides that no one is allowed for some reason, security, then no one can cross, even those with a permit. And the worst part about the permit, especially the ones that divide the West Bank. So these are not, there are checkpoints from the Palestinian territories to the Israeli territories, but there are checkpoints from one Palestinian town to the other, or from one Palestinian area to the other. And the worst part about them is we know too well as Palestinians that these checkpoints are not there for security. They're there to control, even to humiliate. They stop you, but sometimes they don't search you. They delay everything, and then, okay, everybody passes. They are there to intimidate, to remind you that they are in charge. And it's not, as they claim, about security or about making sure that, you know, Palestinians don't infiltrate weapons or so on. I mean, they don't search the cars. So we know why the checkpoints exist, and... I remember even thinking, you know, you have to battle within, not to grow a sense of hatred and revenge, because if it controls you, then it will lead to terrible things. So this was the goal, I think. This has always been the goal, to send the message, we control you. And that's why I always say liberation begins when we fight this tendency to control us.
We've talked about checkpoints. The other big thing is settlements. So they've obviously been expanding and increasing. What's your first memory of a settlement being built close to where you live, or impacting your life in reality as a child? And how has it changed progressively again?
The main change is that we used to see settlers drive by Palestinian towns, especially in the first Intifada. And then that's when Palestinians began, you know, stopping these cars or throwing rocks at these cars. So they created the alternative roads, and they began the clear separation between settlements, the roads that connect settlements, which meant more control of territory and land. In Beit Sahur, the biggest settlement in Bethlehem, that is in our face, as you say, is the Abu Ghneim. They call it Har Huma in Hebrew, which was built on Palestinian land, confiscated, and it was built in the 90s. And Palestinians protested, because this is after Oslo, and now you're taking a big and important important piece of land, just, you know, I wouldn't say outside of Bethlehem, it's in the middle, which will impact our natural growth as a community, let alone the idea that you're taking land from families.
How did it impact it's going back to when you were a young person, but did it impact where you'd play? Did it impact how you were going to visit your friends? How did it actually play out in that you can remember in your life?
In many ways, it's there. It's next to us. And from the psychological impact, because it was a green mountain that my mother told me that they used to go play there as children all the time. Let's go to the woods, as they call them.
Yep.
And now it's this big settlement. It's now fenced out from, you know, an important neighborhood in Beit Sahur and in Bethlehem. So you see them every day and you can't go through. Many times, Israeli military come and drive by. And so it's hard, because it's right at the heart of Bethlehem, that settlement. And as I said, the biggest impact is it prevents our natural growth as a community. And when people think of the shrinking Palestinian Christian community, and I know this is a big topic, especially among churches and sometimes in the Western media, no one has the courage to actually go and say, well, it's these settlements around Bethlehem that were built on Palestinian Christian land that prevent any sustainable life in the future for Palestinian in Bethlehem. And of course, the majority of Palestinian Christians live in the Bethlehem area. And they give a sense of isolation, that you live in a big prison, because the settlements in Bethlehem surround Bethlehem from most angles, and then there is the separation wall. There are roads that are specifically and exclusively for the Israeli settlers to drive on. It's apartheid. I mean, it can't get clearer than that. And we feel that we live in a big prison. To connect it to what's happening in Gaza, Gaza has been under siege for the last 17 years. But it only takes Israel to close two or three checkpoints outside of Bethlehem for Bethlehem to become another Gaza. And the same applies to Tul Karim, to Jenin, to Nablus. Israel has managed to isolate
all the neighborhoods,
the Palestinian life within, isolated communities, gated communities, if you wish, and they control all the roads connecting these communities. And in the so-called deal of the century, it became very clear what the plan is: isolate the Palestinian communities in the West Bank, even within the small territory of the West Bank. That's why you go to the Palestinian cities now, they're very packed, crowded, because we can't grow naturally, horizontally, so we grow vertically. Because Israel has confiscated everything in between.
Yeah, when you, I mean, this not just now, but I mean, in every point of your life, and even your neighbors and other members of the community, when you see settlers, it's obviously not just one consistent feeling, but how do you feel? And have there ever been chances for interaction, and how does that occur?
The main feeling we have when we encounter settlers is fear. Because most settlers have weapons, they use them, and they're never held accountable.
Has this been your experience with settlers from the very beginning, or has it become something that you experienced in the last 5, 6, 7 years?
It has always been like this, but definitely it grew stronger and stronger in the last more than 5 years, but definitely in the last 2 years, and especially in remote areas, in areas that were designated by the Oslo Accords as Area C's. Settler violence has always been something we had to deal with. Unfortunately, it's dangerous, and they're never held accountable. And their activity increased more during the last Israeli government. So a year onward, and then October 7th happened, and most of them got weapons, and this is why right now we say if this war on Gaza escalates to the West Bank, the biggest fear we will have is not just the Israeli military, but the settlers themselves, who have proven that they can be very violent, and many of them hold very strong extreme ideologies. If you ask me personally, how do I feel when I encounter settlers? It's fear. It's fear.
Any positive experience with encountering settlers?
Not for me personally, to be honest.
Any anecdotes that you know of?
There are stories, I think, of settlers and Palestinian villagers trying to cooperate in certain areas, especially farming and so on. But the vast majority of our experience has been a very negative one. And settlers always, you know, you have to understand that the ideology is one of domination and control. And so even if they, you know, try to deal with Palestinians, it comes from a sense of superiority. The ideology promoted by many settlers today is one of Jews have an exclusive right to all the land. So how can you survive in such an ideology, especially when they have the upper hand all the time?
Let's talk a bit about the church and Palestinian Christians and how you're perceived by the church globally. And I mean, obviously, that's a big question, because there are many different churches. And I also want to differentiate between evangelicalism and evangelical Zionism, which we'll speak about later on, and just you know, like the church community. Do you feel embraced by the church community? Do you not feel embraced? How do you feel about that?
It's not an easy relationship, and it has always been a complicated relationship. And before I answer, and those who know me know that I have been very critical of the Western Church when it comes to their stance on Palestine, and not just the evangelicals and not just the Christian Zionists, but mainline churches. But before that, I think it's important to acknowledge that there are many who are in solidarity with us, and there's a growing number of Christians around the world who are for justice, who are for the liberation of the oppressed, who are in solidarity with us. And I don't want to, as if ignore and whitewash all Western Christians as if they are all pro-Israel. That's not the case. But sadly, the ones who are pro-Israel have caused so much damage. First to the Christian witness, before anything, to me as a pastor, I say this, but also to our lives as Palestinian Christians. And that's why we've been very vocal and very critical. And let me also acknowledge the fact that there are many in the Global South who are also growing in their understanding and support and solidarity to Palestinian Christians, most notably in South Africa. The church in South Africa has been amazing in its powerful prophetic voice, unwavering support and courage in calling out Israeli crimes. And in some way, what we saw at the ICJ did not surprise us as Palestinian Christians, because we've always seen this coming from the South African church. Yet, the fact remains that many Christians around the world have adopted positions, not just theological positions, but also political positions that have caused so much damage to us.
Why? What do you think it's at the heart of it? Do you think it's ignorance? Do you think it's misconception? Do you think it's racism? What do you think is at the heart of it?
So this is a question we've thought a lot about. And there was a time when I thought actually it's a certain biblical understanding. It's theology, or what I would say, bad theology. There was a time when I thought, if we can explain from the Bible that certain theology that supports Israel is actually, we can challenge it biblically, maybe we can change some positions. But the deeper you dig into that movement, the more you understand that there's so much what I call coloniality in it, and definitely racism. I think the church many times want to side with power. And there is a strong connection, shamefully I would say, between Western Christianity and colonialism that many of us have called out in the past and continue to call out today, because we see it continuing, especially with the support to Israel. And the idea of creating an entity in the Middle East as an extension to empire, and then finding a theology to justify that, is at the heart of what we call today Christian Zionism. So we need to think of Christian Zionism more than just a theological position, as if this is how we understand the Bible. But there is a strong sense of coloniality and even racism. And let me give examples what I mean. When I talk about racism, for example, and the idea of a land without people, Palestine as a land without people, for a people without a land. This idea, which we associate with Zionism, actually began among Christian Zionists in England, in Britain, who wanted to find a solution for the so-called Jewish problem in the West, which stemmed from attitudes of racism, anti-Semitism towards Jews in Europe. And the solution was, or the vision was, Jews must convert to Christianity. Then they gave it a theological term, the restoration of Israel. For that to happen, they must be in Palestine, and they could be strong allies to us in the Middle East. So it's both the idea of an extension to an empire, but also the racism towards the Jewish people that led to this. But then when you think of the term a land without people, and remember that, as I said, Christians promoted it before Zionists did, you think, did they know that the land had people? And of course they did. Yet they still talked about our land as a land without people, because they don't see us as equals. So yes, the land had people, but we could easily ask them to go out and create space for the new immigrants to create the new state. This is what I mean by not just superiority, but also clear racism. To think that you can divide Palestine, or think of the Balfour Declaration, promising someone else's land to others, and of course, then coming up with a theology to justify it, and convincing the whole world that Jews are entitled to the land because they lived here 2,000 years ago, imposing your own religious beliefs on others, because you're right, because today they use the language, we're the civilized. So you can impose your theological or religious beliefs on others, and they have to accept, and if they don't, it's their fault, it's their problem. Because in honesty, if we think of the logic behind the creation of Israel and try to apply it on any other context, it will be unthinkable. It will be unthinkable to think of imposing the idea that a certain religion promised a certain group of people a certain piece of land, and those living on that piece of land have to accept that theological or religious belief and leave that land and give space to the new incomers, because thousands of years ago God promised them the land.
Do you think there's a sense among maybe church groups, Christian church groups, that don't maybe give you your dues? Do you think there's a sense that, why are you there? You are there with the Arabs, who are mainly Muslim. Do you think there's a sense of that as well, or do you just think it's, I mean, what's your response to that?
Many times we've said, and I've said, that for many Western Christian leaders, again, not all, but for some at least, they prefer a Holy Land without Palestinian Christians, maybe a museum. Because if you think of
because
what happened...
Because it makes it simpler for them to understand the conflict, or...
Yes, and they don't have to deal with us because of their natural connection and alliance with Israel. Because in some sense, and Reverend Mitri Raheb, a Palestinian theologian, wrote extensively about this, the idea of Israel replaced Palestinian Christians. Because for centuries, when you think of the Holy Land, you think of the church there. I'm talking about from a Western mindset. You think of the church there, pilgrimage. And then, since Israel was created, for Western Christians, when they think of the Holy Land, they think of Israel. They replaced us. They dismissed us. But we're still there. And that's why many times we've been silenced. I don't know how many people know this, but the idea of silencing Palestinian Christians, and I'm not talking about Israel silencing us. That happens for sure. Israel has tried to silence us for many times, for years, and they tried to delegitimize us. I'm talking about church leaders and Christian organizations that tried to silence Palestinian Christians.
How have you, give me examples of how you've seen this?
Well, many times I've been invited to speak in conferences, and then my invitation is withdrawn because it's controversial to bring a Palestinian Christian. We've been silenced when it comes to how churches phrase their positions about the Holy Land. They talk about Israel, Jewish restoration, the so-called Jews returning to their land, as if the land is empty. And they mention us by saying the human rights of Palestinians must be respected. So when I say we're silenced, we're not partners on the table in shaping opinions. Especially when they know that we can challenge their comfort zone, because we are clear in that the problem is Israel's occupation policies, Zionism's exclusive ideologies, and right now apartheid on the ground. And they don't want to hear that because to them, Israel is an ally for several reasons, as I mentioned. we continue to challenge their comfort zone, and they prefer not to engage with us. And this is why many try to promote this conflict as a religious conflict. And we will continue to insist it's not a religious conflict. Don't make it a conflict between Jews and Muslims. This is not the case. The idea of making it a conflict between Jews and Muslims is actually convenient to some, because it makes it, to them at least, a clear battle between black and white, good and evil, with good being the Judeo-Christian tradition, which references maybe cultural superiority, versus radical Islam. And we continue to reject that moment, that notion. And I think for that reason, we are being silenced and continue to be silenced in many circles today. Even, you know, with all that's happening right now in Gaza and with our appeals, we still have Christian circles in the West who don't want to listen to us, who don't want to invite us, and who continue to promote the Zionist narrative that this is a self-defense, and even minimize the numbers of Palestinian casualties, or are silent about what's happening.
The Pope has said, I mean, he's come out quite strongly, almost from, I mean, not, I wouldn't say strongly, but he has said unequivocally, he's sided, you know, with the fact that what Israel is doing is really quite horrific. How does that make you feel? Does it give you hope?
So I think it's important, as I said, to emphasize, there are many Christian leaders who have spoken. And I think the Pope has addressed this more from a humanitarian angle. It's his personality, and he's a very compassionate leader. And I think we need this. We need to reclaim morality in leadership and in political leadership. And the Pope has been very strong in his description of what's happening in Gaza. And how can't you be when you see all this numbers, and not just the numbers, but the fact that we see images of children on a daily basis killed in horrific ways. But we need more than just strong words. I think that we need to be forceful in our demand for a ceasefire right now. Many Christians have raised their concern. Many Christians have said this is horrible. But unless we are determined and forceful and say enough is enough, this must stop, and unless we call for accountability, I think we're not going anywhere. This is what we need more right now from leaders around the world. And by the way, you know, people ask me, why do you only criticize church leaders? Other faiths are... You know, I'm a Christian. I'm only responsible from...
It starts at home.
...for what my people do.
Let's move to actually the evangelical Christians, specifically the very strong Christian Zionist movements in the USA. I'm guessing you know John Hagley and these kind of individuals. Who, I mean, I wouldn't... many would say don't just have, you know, quite radical ideas on Israel, but have ideas on where women should be working, have quite radical anti-LGBTQ ideas. If you could actually sit down with John Hagley and speak to him, what would you try to say?
I'm not sure he would want to sit down with me to begin with. I would call him to repent from his obsession with power, with a militant solution to everything, in his unwavering and uncritical support to an apartheid regime, for his constant dehumanization of Palestinians, and for refusing to open his eyes to the suffering of Palestinians now for more than 75 years, 76 years. I would challenge him to rediscover the way of Jesus, the way of peace, the way of compassion. I don't recognize the gospel in many of these leaders who openly have called for Israel, some of them, to turn Gaza into a parking lot. It's shocking to us how distant they are from the very same teachings of Jesus. And don't tell me it's all about a certain theological belief or how they understand the Bible. No, it's much more than that. That's why we talk about the weaponization of the Bible. The Bible has been weaponized by the empire, as we call it, to justify growth, colonialism, and to justify our intoxication with power. So I'm troubled with evangelical Christians who say these things and do these things on multiple levels, beginning with the impact they have on the Christian witness. This is not Jesus' way. For sure this is not Jesus' way. And then I'm troubled by the impact they have on our lives as Palestinians. Because John Hagee and others, and it's not just him, but he's as if the face of that movement, but many, many others. Christian Zionism is a political movement today. They are engaged in political lobbying on behalf of Israel, especially in American politics. When Trump moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the American embassy, he said, and I quote, "I did it for the evangelicals." So this is how influential they are. They give millions of dollars. Actually, one organization alone gave more than $1.5 billion, raised $1.4 billion from the 70s until today, from evangelical churches to Israel.
And this is for support of the IDF or for settlements?
Settlements, IDF, and other humanitarian, as they call it. But most of it goes to settlements and IDF. And it's as if Israel is not receiving enough money from the USA. So as Palestinians, we are suffering because of what they're doing. And then to add on all of that, as Palestinian Christians, they are posing an existential threat on us. Our future is at stake here as a Palestinian Christian community, but they could care less.
Let's now try to speak about navigating Palestinian resistance and Palestinian activism as a Palestinian Christian community. Do you feel that you've been embraced, or do you feel you work alongside, or do you think what has it been like working? I mean, primarily Palestinian resistance groups are secular and also are seen as Islamic or whatever it may be. Where do you think your activism fits in, and how is it always meshed with the broader umbrella of Palestinian resistance?
I think we're part of the Palestinian movement, definitely. But we tackle things from a faith perspective, for sure. And I think people realize how much needed our, and we realize that we are needed because of how theology have been used against us. Everyone in Palestine knows about Christian Zionism. Everyone in the Middle East knows about Christian Zionism. And they see how important our voice is, because we are at the front lines of challenging Christian Zionism. They see how important our voices are and our activism have been over the years.
Do you think this has always been the case? Do you think this is indigenous and very organic to your entire Palestinian society? Or do you think it's something that, as Christian Zionism has become more of a challenge to Palestinians, then it's sort of been a strategic embrace? Not an insincere strategic embrace, but there's been an acknowledgement that, hey, this is a very important voice as well.
It's definitely a growing phenomenon, but it has always been there. I mean, we know of attempts from the very beginning of the 20th century of Palestinian Christians who saw what Zionism is saying about Palestine and tried to challenge it. So there has always been attempts by Palestinian Christians to challenge, from a faith perspective, from a theological perspective, the arguments of Zionism and Christian Zionism. And we continue to see it over history. There are studies of the growth of Palestinian Christian theology until I think there are many defining moments and leading personalities who inspired others to speak up and to think in such a way and to join our advocacy efforts to the extent to where we are right now today, where there are many voices, many Palestinian Christian voices, strong theological movements, Sabil, Kairos, Christ at the Checkpoint, Al-Liqa, Dar al-Kalima, many notable theologians who write in different languages, who speak in churches around the world, many studies about this phenomena of Palestinian theology, and Kairos Palestine has been very influential to many in forcing churches to respond to Palestinian Christian voices, because Kairos Palestine brought many voices together and created the document in 2009 that is considered today as if the blueprint of our voices as Palestinian Christian activists on the ground. And it went beyond just this is what we believe, into calling churches to act, into calling churches to costly solidarity, into embracing the concept of creative nonviolent resistance.
What is creative nonviolent resistance?
Creative nonviolent resistance is the way I understand it, and the way I understand it shaped by the Kairos theology, is having the courage to call things by their name and to resist evil with good, to call out occupation as a sin, apartheid as a sin, to resist it. Kairos Palestine says resistance is the right and duty of every Christian. But then it says it's resistance in the logic of love, meaning that it doesn't seek to revenge or to eliminate the opponent, but to correct and challenge peacefully, but actively and creatively. So examples could be civil disobedience. Examples could be resilience, so mood, staying in the land, keeping our memory, our culture, our identity, because this is what Israel has been trying to eliminate for years. Theologically, what we're doing is really important. And then we see in many community initiatives that call for boycotting, divesting, sanctioning Israel as means of creative resistance. And in fact, we've challenged churches to consider their own investments, because many big churches have endowment funds and so on. How are you investing your money? Are you investing it ethically? And actually, many churches responded by divesting from companies that work in settlements. Many churches have openly called for boycotting settlements. And so this is how we see creative nonviolent resistance. And I think it's a very effective tool if we want to really end the occupation.
Let's start moving to what's currently occurring, the devastation and the humanitarian disaster in Gaza. If you could go back, and it's probably quite difficult, but if you could just go back to your frame of mind on October 6th, where did you feel the Palestinian movement was? Where do you think the Palestinian potential liberation was? How did you feel as a Palestinian?
If you, and I'm someone who meets regularly with church leaders in Palestine and diplomats even, and I can recall too well the many, many conversations we've had in the months leading to October 7th. And among the things that I continued to highlight was the current status quo is not sustainable. I was talking about the status quo in general, not just about Gaza. I always said Gaza is hell on earth, and that it's an illustration how we as humanity can grow numb into suffering. Because how are we at peace with ourselves with 16 years of siege and dehumanization of the people of Gaza, even to the extent of bombing them and blaming them? And this was all before October 7th that we were saying these things. We were warning that when it explodes next time, it's going to be very violent, and will we survive this? Sadly to say, we saw it coming. Sadly to say, we were warning about the policies and positions of the current Israeli government, and the fact that they delegitimize our Palestinian efforts. And I was always challenging churches with the idea that, and diplomats, Israel has killed the two-state solution. So what's next? What are you doing? What are you saying? When will you ever hold Israel accountable? And again, we were saying all of this before October 7th.
Was the feeling, though, of just continuous malaise and depression and non-hope, or was it the feeling of there's an impending massive doom upon us?
Exactly, and despair.
So which one? Was it the first or the
No, despair and doom. Okay. It's like, it's the worst I've seen before October 7th. We were warning
but was there a sense that there's going to be some big event? Or was it just,
yes,
this is just...
So there was a sense that the world seemed okay with the current status quo. There was a sense that Israel has succeeded in normalizing apartheid. Because when the many reports, I think 2 years ago now, came out almost one after the other, B'Tselem, Amnesty International, and Human Rights Watch, and many other reports, all saying with clear language, there's apartheid. And no one did anything. No one responded swiftly in saying, we're concerned. There was a sense that nothing's going to happen. Israel has normalized the current status quo. But there was also the fear that it will explode. And we were more thinking of what's happening in Nablus and Jenin, fearing that it could explode to the West Bank. And I think all of us were surprised by October 7th. We continue to be surprised by how devastating the aftermath of October 7th, which is still unfolding in front of our eyes, is. But we saw all of this big explosion coming, because the current status quo before October 7th, I kept saying, we kept saying, is not sustainable.
We will speak about what's occurred since October 7th, but let's return to October 7th itself. What's your reflections and thoughts and response to what Hamas did on October 7th?
We were all surprised, to be honest. We didn't know what to think. It's as if, you know, a pressure cooker exploded. October 7th is the culmination of years of oppression. And we must put it in context. And when we say we must put it in context, this is not to justify everything that happened in October 7th. As a pastor, I don't condone violence to begin with, but especially when it's violence against children and innocent people or the kidnapping of children. Cannot accept that. But when we say we must see October 7th in its context, we are pointing to the fact that for 16 years, these people have been systematically dehumanized. And for 76 years, 75 years, these people have been systematically denied their rights. Put yourself in their shoes. How would you react? How would you respond? I lament all violence, but at a certain point we must think, where did this violence come from? If the one of, you know, you can choose to simplify things and simply say it's a terrorist hateful ideology that's behind October 7th. And when you do so, you only continue the dehumanization of Palestinians. Or you could choose the more difficult path, but the right path of asking, what led us to October 7th? What led these young Palestinians to have no concern for their own lives when they go and attack these military bases? And by the way, I don't think anybody expected, not even Hamas leaders themselves, that they will manage to, you know, conquer these military bases and go deeper into Israeli territories. And let's not forget that a lot of the things that happened in October 7th happened from the people who escaped Gaza and went into these towns and in some cases committed these horrible things against civilians. So we must ask, what led to October 7th? We must ask, you know, what do we expect from, you know, I was reading about how in some studies the high suicide rate among young people of Gaza whose only experience has been living under a brutal siege. The high unemployment in Gaza. So what led to all of this? We have to ask these questions. And I think that October 7th, and please understand, I'm not saying this with joy or... October 7th helped dismantle the myth that security can be bought or can happen through violence and oppression.
It's now almost been almost 5 months. More than 100,000 Palestinians are either dead or under the rubble or injured in some way. All the Palestinians, almost the entire population of Gaza, is now in Rafah. And there's an impending ground operation that's possibly gonna push people into Egypt. Already Egypt are constructing makeshift accommodation in the buffer zone. When Israel responded, then, given your entire history of your life, knowing what Israel is capable of, even then, did you think that the response will be as brutal as it has been?
We knew that it's going to be a very, very brutal response, yes. But I've never expected it to last this long. I've never expected the world to continue to be fine or not doing enough to stop this after more than, 4 months now? Early on, we understood that Israel is engaged in a vengeance campaign. Early on, we knew too well this is not about eliminating Hamas. It was clear to us as Palestinians. It was clear to us that Israel wants to create a new reality and ethnically cleanse Gaza and push Palestinians outside of Gaza. It was clear. Actually, they told us this. The Israeli leaders told us this. Yet everybody kept insisting Israel has the right to exercise self-defense. And if you follow even what we as Palestinian theologians have been saying, I mean, from October we were saying this is ethnic cleansing and these are war crimes. We knew too well that if you follow the statements from Israeli leaders and the indiscriminatory bombing of Gaza, and then later how they destroyed all the infrastructure. And it was clear what they were doing. They were annihilating Gaza and making sure that life in Gaza will never be back the same way it was. We knew too well that this is a very aggressive vengeance campaign. My own sense of fear was assured when I saw one political leader after the other show up to Tel Aviv, provide political cover. In some cases, church leaders coming to provide theological cover, make sure to tell Israel we will pay the bill. And now they want to convince us that they are somehow concerned or not pleased with how Israel responded. So when I saw them coming, we realized now Israel has the green light to commit a genocide. And that's when we began pleading and calling. Even as I said, from October and early November, a genocide is going to happen. Stop this. Stop this. No one listened. Actually, we were accused of not having concern for Israel's future and so on, and this is only self-defense. Now it's been 130 days. Are they willing to admit that they were wrong? And it's going to be too late anyways. And this is why, you know, you've heard us and you've heard me saying you're complicit to these leaders, whether politicians or whoever. When you're silent, when you didn't see this coming, even though we told you and the Israelis themselves told you what they were doing, you're complicit. You're complicit in all of this.
Do you have friends or family in Gaza?
I have friends and relatives of friends in Gaza.
And have you been able to be in communication with them any time in this last period? What's that been like? Any personal anecdotes of how these people have been affected?
They tell us horror stories. We talk to them, and the stories they tell us are literally horror stories of constant bombing, not being able to sleep, of lack of food. A woman, so most of the people we talk to are the Christians in the church. A woman was left the church to go to her house, which is very close to the church, was shot and left bleeding for almost 24 hours and died. She was talking on the phone to them, pleading, can someone come and help me? But no one could go and reach her. People dying because of lack of medication. If you get sick right now in Gaza, chances are very high you won't survive it. And many people are dying, not because they are shot or bombed, but because they get sick and there is no health system in Gaza. They tell us of bodies in the streets, and I'm really sorry to say this, dogs eating those bodies. I mean, this is the kind of horror stories they tell us about. And then the total destruction of the infrastructure. Everything is damaged. So the amount of, you know, trying to think, put myself in their shoes. Everybody in Gaza knows that they could die at any second right now. Even those who sought shelter in the church know this, because churches were bombed and two women were killed by snipers in the church campus itself. So they know that at any second their lives could end. They're not sure if they will have food for the next 2 days or 3 days. And then on the back of their mind, they think, what if we survive this war? Where will we live? Our homes are destroyed. These are the ones who decided not to go south to Rafah. And some of them said, we don't want to become refugees again. Some told me, I'd rather die in the church rather than go to the unknown and end up in a refugee camp somewhere that I don't know where it will be.
You've lived under occupation your whole life. Did you ever think that, I mean, many people have said that what's happening now is like the Nakba, some have said it's even worse. Did you ever think that, that you would live and actually see an event like this?
No. And it's definitely worse than the Nakba. I'm horrified by the fact that the world is okay with the crime of ethnic cleansing happening in front of everybody's eyes, and the world seems okay. And in the West Bank right now, we know that this could be our fate one day. Who would stop Israel from pushing us all to Jordan in the West Bank? If the world was okay with doing it to Gaza under the pretext of self-defense, so then all it takes is an incident for Israel to push us out of the West Bank into Jordan. Especially when you see the silence of world leaders and the approval of the world. When I say we will not recover as a humanity, I don't think we will recover easily from approving and being silent and complicit with the genocide and ethnic cleansing that's happening and unfolding in front of everybody's eyes. And it's not as if people don't know. You know, sometimes when these things happen, people are, quote, horrified with the aftermath. They go on, we didn't know, but now you see it. Even worse, the Israeli soldiers are now bragging about it.
When you see that, when you see Israeli soldiers bragging about what they've done, or mocking or jeering at Palestinians for what they've done, how do you feel?
It's, you know, we get angry, and all I can do is pray and say, Lord, we need justice. We need justice in this land. Bring the proud down. And at a deeper level, it shows, you know, I feel sorry for humanity that we get into such level of even mocking the destruction of a civilization. It's so sad. It's really so sad that we as humanity could reach such levels in which we mock not just the killing but the destruction of a whole community.
How is everything that I mean, you may not even, I don't think many people have processed it yet, but how do you think it's changed you?
How did it change me? I think we knew who our friends are and who our pretend friends are. I think it changed the way I look at what does it mean to be a good Christian. Because the idea of seeing a genocide and being silent or not doing anything is something I've been thinking about. This is what I mean. And the sense of we cannot rely on anybody but ourselves as Palestinians for survival. For, you know, this is our resilience. We are a resilient people. And if you think, And I'm not minimizing the support and solidarity of many, many around the world. But if you really think of it, we're facing all of this alone. And the only thing we have is our resilience and ourselves. We're grateful for the support of many. We're grateful for South Africa's courage. We're grateful for all the humanitarian aid and those who are willing to come and help us rebuild Gaza. But this war confirmed to us that a genocide and ethnic cleansing could happen in front of everybody's eyes. And people will know too well what's happening, but they will lack the courage to stop it. And I don't think this will ever, we will never, I don't think we will ever forget this. It will ever be, it will forever be inside of us as Palestinians that the world was watching.
What do you think, and I mean this can actually be quite difficult to even comprehend, but what do you think realistically happens next?
I have no idea. And all we're thinking of right now is pleading for this genocide to end. And then we'll talk. And then we'll think. What worries me is that it seems everybody's talking about what's next. And I've read so much about the day after. But we're not there yet. Let's talk about ending it now, before we talk about the day. Because if we have to agree what happens the day after, and then we bring this war into an end, it's catastrophic if we think this way.
Why is it catastrophic?
Because it will extend. It will keep happening until we think what happens next. And this is, it's what we're seeing right now. Politicians can't agree on not just the ceasefire deal, but on what's next. And that's why it seems the ceasefire did not happen. And what's really frustrating is that everybody's talking, but sometimes you get the sense that Palestinians are not involved in these negotiations. They're talking about us without us. The same way, you know, the so-called Abraham Accords happened and other deals were being discussed without us. And who's going to rebuild Gaza? It's a question everybody's asking now. Who's going to be in charge of the rebuilding of Gaza?
I mean, it's an assumption that Gaza can potentially be rebuilt at this point. That's the reality, the sad reality.
I mean, it's going to take at least a year just to get rid of the rubble. The whole infrastructure
is... it also depends on Israel complying with that.
Yeah.
And I think most people don't... I mean, it's almost like the October 8th moment where, you know, there's been clear signs that that's not what Israel wants, but there's hope that maybe they'll stop this eventually.
And given the history of the last 76 years, when was the world ever able to put red lines in front of Israel? Think of the settlements. They kept saying, stop the settlements. Yeah, we saw where that went. Two-state solution, we saw where that. So now when everybody is saying Gaza must be rebuilt and Palestinians must return to their homes. I mean, return to what? And yeah, will Israel allow it?
Do you manage, and how have you managed to keep anger at bay?
It's important to be angry, and it's important to let go of our frustration, but channel it in the right direction. Anger is different than hatred, and if we are not angry, shaken by what's happening right now, then there's something wrong with our humanity. And the right way is to channel this anger into a movement, into energy, and not give in to despair. And I've tried from the beginning to try to be positive about this anger and channel it into constructive work. First by writing, by advocacy, by using the social media today, by mobilizing my community, whether it's the Palestinian Christian community or the global Christian community, into action. And when we think this way, because what options do we have? We could turn a blind eye. And say we can't do anything about it. Israel will just do what it wants to do. And I've refused to take that stand. And being angry about something is important because it moves you to want to change it. And as such, I've been, to a certain degree, grateful, and I'm very careful how I use this word, because the world has not ended. But, you know, our voices were heard around the world. And I think we managed, and let's give credit to the people of Gaza themselves. If I did anything, was to channel that anger about their resilience, their suffering, into words that people heard around the world. I think we awakened many consciences around the world. I know this. And I think we mobilized many, many people around the world to speak, to change, to act, to demonstrate, pleading for a ceasefire. And I don't want to tone down this frustration and anger, even our lament about what's happening. Because if I'm not angry, that means I'm fine with the status quo. And I refuse to normalize a genocide.
It's now been almost 107 years, or about 107 years since Balfour's declaration. And we've had a long discussion, and more importantly, there's been a lived reality of 170 years of difficulty. If you could go back and speak to Balfour, what would you want to tell him?
This is colonialism at its worst. This is the prejudice of the colonial forces who believe they have the right, that they are entitled to decide other people's fate just because they are able to. Would my words have made a difference? Is the issue a matter of if they only knew? No, they knew. Did they care? And that's a question. How can you change that? How can you impact that? How can you, if there is no compassion, can I help a person like this? Can I impact a person like this? Such attitudes that lack empathy and see others as inferior. This is the tragedy. This is the legacy of Balfour. This is the legacy of colonialism. So what would I have say to him? Does he see us as equal? Does he see Palestinians as deserving of dignity and life? You know, sometimes we joke, why didn't you pledge or promise Wales as homeland for the Jewish people? Why Palestine? Would you have accepted this on your people? Would you accept to divide your land and ask your people to let go of their identity and rootedness and heritage? Really? Many studies point to Balfour's own religious sentiments behind the Balfour Declaration. And as
Zionist,
I said...
Christian Zionist sentiments?
Yeah, so. Yeah, definitely. And as I said, this is far away from the Jesus way. Jesus said, do to others what you want others to do to you. Would you be okay if I ask you to... Or not ask, I mean, he didn't ask for our permission. Would you be okay if we promise half of Wales to someone else or half of Scotland to someone else?
If you could speak to an Israeli child 20 years in the future, what would you think you would be telling this person, this child?
I've always said that my dream is for my children to have Israeli friends. Will I ever to live to see this dream? I don't know. Our vision must be one of sharing the land. There are right now close to 15 million people in the so-called Holy Land in Palestine, historic Palestine, Palestine into Israel, whatever you want to call it. And the choices are simple. Either one of us eliminates the other, or create a status quo in which they control the other, which is what we have right now, and it's never sustainable, or we acknowledge that we have to share this land as equals. I think this is the only way forward. What does this mean politically? I don't know. We can find ways, if we have the will, to look at each other as equals. The tragedy of this war and this genocide is that it has created a big gap between our two peoples. And not just fear of the other, but the dehumanization of the other. Again, I think of the soldiers who mock the destruction of Gaza. Can we reach a point in which we actually, you know, believe that we can live together as equals in this land? What I hope Israelis understand, whether you want me to tell it to an Israeli child in the future or now, or is that Palestinians have been living in this land, in our land, for generations upon generations. Palestine is our home. We don't have any other home. And we're not going anywhere. And that we will never let go of our God-given right to live in peace in our land. Ultimately, we have to share this land. And apartheid is not the way forward. The logic of might and power is definitely not the way forward. It's intoxicating. We have to have respect for human lives, for human dignity, for the other. And we have to understand that it's only when we see each other as equals in this land that we can have a way forward to live in peace in this land.
And if you could speak to a Palestinian child 20 years in the future, what would you tell this child?
Don't give up. Don't leave. Embrace your identity. Embrace this struggle. It's a human struggle. We have a message to the world. Let's embrace this calling. It's not a calling we have chosen. But in a profound way, the Palestinian cause has divided our world today. I said in my sermon that Gaza has become the moral compass of the world. And I think this comes with a responsibility. So we have to continue with this struggle. We have to persist. And I would say, don't give up on the dream to build life in this land, to build a future for our children in this land. I think of the message we will send to the world, to humanity, when we manage to do so. And it's how we do it. I hope we do it with dignity. I hope we do it with respect to life. And I hope that we send a message to the world that Palestinians can and will build their own futures and build their own and determine their own destiny one day.
Thank you so much for joining us, Munthar Ishaq. It's been a good and long conversation. Thank you very much. See you guys.
Thank you.